Well, hey, everybody. Welcome back to X-Files Diaries. I'm Annie.
I'm Jen.
Still coming off the high from last week, Jen. Our interview with Frank, which is probably one of the highlights of our entire podcast existence so far, I would definitely have to say.
I might go so far as to say it's one of the highlights of my entire existence, period, podcast or otherwise, but definitely podcast wise.
It's true.
It was amazing. I mean, I was looking back on the tweets from the episode over the past week, and I'm reading them and I'm like, did this really happen? Like, I still can't believe it.
Yeah.
I still can't believe it all really happened because it was so awesome.
Oh yeah. Well, before we get to today's show, which is going to be another mythology based show in our sort of journey through the mythology, why don't you read some tweets from last week, Jen?
Let's do it.
He's made outrageous public statements on an internet site.
That wasn't him. That was me. And they're not outrageous.
Okay, so tweets of the week. Let's start with one from a guy that I think maybe we know. His name, apparently, Frank Spotnitz, with a little blue check. It's our first blue check on tweets of the week here on X-Files Diaries, which is pretty exciting. Not that you guys aren't all special, but I mean, there's, you know, it's Frank. We all know that. So Frank tweeted out our podcast interview with him last week, which we really appreciate, all the wonderful support that we've been getting from Frank and his folks. Frank said, I sat down with the girls and had a walk down the X-Files memory lane. Hope that you enjoyed this broadcast. And we were both saying that we were really quite tickled by being referred to as the girls
right.
by Frank Spotnitz. It's
right.
like, yeah, like, we're his girls. It's like Charlie's Angels or something.
I love it. I dig it. I'll take it because it's Frank. It was actually really funny on his site. He wrote something about on his website. He wrote something about how we were a delight to talk to.
Yes,
and
he did.
I wanted to say, contrary to popular belief, people, I'm a delight to talk to.
You are. Everyone who listens to the podcast knows that.
I just thought it was really funny. And you were a delight to talk to as well, Frank. So
of course. Yes, he was very delightful. Could not have been more delightful, actually. It was the best. I'm going to start swooning, frankly, over the whole thing. I can hardly stand to listen to it myself because it's so overwhelmingly exciting for me. And we also got a great retweet from Avi, who is Frank's sort of social media manager type person and a great person. We love you, Avi. And I loved how she retweeted the podcast tweet. She says, in which the boss, Frank Spotnitz, confirms his shipper status.
Oh, yes.
Thanks, Abby. We love it. We love it.
So. There was never any doubt, but I loved having all of that, audible proof. It was great.
Yeah, it's on the record forever now. And that's a wonderful, wonderful thing. We had lots of great feedback from lots of different folks on the interview. So thanks everybody for those. Just a handful that I'm going to read today. One from Gigi, who's talking about Frank saying, this is Frank talking here. I hope I can answer all your questions because it was so long ago and I don't remember much. Also, Frank quotes verbatim, which is exactly what happened, because he's all like, oh, I don't know if I can remember that. But then he's like, boom, 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 remembers. I mean, episode titles, no problem, remembers all kinds of different specifics. He was amazing.
I think Frank knows more than he's letting on, and he's being very diplomatic, which I appreciate. I'm sure everyone appreciates it, but
he is. Yeah, he's amazing. He's just a really all round, very sort of thoughtful, great, and really super smart guy as well.
It's refreshing to see an executive producer being a fan of their own show.
Yeah, right, right. Yeah. I mean, that was one of the main takeaways that I took from our interview with Frank was how much he loves the show and loves the characters. Sometimes when it comes to being, you know, part of a fandom, the fans can feel like we're the only ones that really care about the characters. But, you know, Frank really reinforced for me how much he genuinely cared and loved Mulder and Scully and how much they meant to him and still do. And that was really encouraging and great to hear. So from Jesse. Jesse said, love this interview. Thank you, Frank, Annie, and Jen, for giving us a look into the heart of Mulder and Scully. My shipper heart has all the feels today, right? That was
a lot of shipper hearts had a lot of feels that day.
Totally. My shipper heart hasn't stopped feeling. and from Lori Hodges. Hey, Lori. She says, I should say they, because Lori can be a guy. They say, first time listener to your podcast. Welcome, Lori. It was awesome. Learned a lot of new things, even though I've been watching since 94. Thanks. Thanks, Lori. And yeah, we're all about learning new things. And boy, I definitely learned some new things from Frank, which was amazing. There's always, I mean, I feel like we could have Frank on every week and just get a golden number of wonderful moments and insights. Could we get him as like a third co-host, do you think, or something? Do you think he'd like would just join us?
Yeah.
On every episode, and we could just like just shoot the shit about the X-Files every time with Frank's botnets. How awesome would that be?
Let's not push our luck, Jen.
Okay, probably not, but I can dream.
Let's dream.
From the Robbins gang. Be still my shipper heart. Just finished listening while working. This was amazing. Kudos to Annie and Jen. This literally sounded like three friends just hanging out talking. Oh. And hats off to Frank. Always a treat to get some behind the scenes insight. Absolutely. And I like the Robbins gang. Hashtag don't give up the ship. Exactly. Yeah. Never.
Never.
Never. We're piloting that ship onwards forever here on X-Files Diaries. From Iggy, no, Ingi, also known as Ingrid, your interview with Frank Spotnitz was fantastic. So many great questions, and Frank was just amazing. So glad you guys had a chance to interview him. So are we. Thank you so much for sharing with us. Like Jen, I watched when it first aired, and at the time I had a really hard time with Doggett. It was all very difficult without Mulder. Mm-hmm. And yes, the brain thing with Mulder at the time pissed me off. But later on, when I rewatched, it totally made sense. What bugs me is that there was no mention of it before and that Scully didn't know, even though I do think that is totally in character for Mulder not to have told her. Yeah, I guess. Yeah, it is.
Yeah.
I don't disagree with any of that, Ingrid. I mean, yes.
You know, Jen, you're allowed to feel your feels about it.
I totally will.
There is nothing wrong with it, you know. But, you know, there's another side is all I'm saying.
I know. Okay. I respect that. I respect people that have learned to love the brain disease.
Join us over here. We have cookies.
I
shaped like tiny diseased brains.
I love it, like a CAT scan cookie or something like that.
Yep.
That's amazing. I really, probably it would be better for my mental and physical and spiritual health if I did learn to love the brain disease, because it bothers me really more than it should. Mm. So thanks to everyone that's really doing their very best to make me love it. From Science Blue, hello. Love the interview with Frank. You and Annie had great questions and the answers were very interesting. That's how it's really spelled too. Very interesting. Love from Portugal to all three of you. Oh, thanks, Science Blue, way over in Portugal. Makes me so happy.
I like hearing listeners in like different countries. That's awesome.
Isn't that incredible? It's like sometimes it just blows my mind that folks
Seriously,
are listening to us.
Send us a tweet if you're outside the Canada or the United States. Tell us where you're from. We love to hear that stuff.
We love that shit. It's just like, it makes us feel really sort of like international, like we're just like international media personalities, which is really awesome. And I'm also like super impressed by multilingual people as well, because I can speak like 1.5 languages, and these folks that are all like, boom, bam, boom, I can speak Portuguese, I can speak English. It's like, wow.
Yeah.
Amazing. So, yeah, thanks, guys, for that. And one last tweet in response to the Frank interview. This was from Rachel Dwyer. I feel like there will be MSR fanfics inspired solely based on the interview with Frank Spotnitz on X-Files Diaries. That was almost my favorite of all of the responses we got, I think, because it's like that. Could there be any higher praise from a shipper than to think that something that we learned is going to inspire a fanfic? Because that's the top as far as I'm concerned.
My favorite thing about that question, because I think that what the one she's referring to is when we asked how he would write that scene,
oh,
was
yeah,
was that he had an answer prepared. Like it wasn't like something he had to make up. Like I feel like he thought about it, which was awesome.
I feel like Frank is ready to go.
I think that if he ever had the opportunity, he would take that scene over and he would do a bang up job. No pun intended, but
he's like
sorry.
It's so amazing how he still has such a strong sense of the characters that I feel like he could just right now write an X-Files episode and it would be absolutely perfect in terms of the characterization, which we'd expect nothing left from Frank, of course. So thanks everybody for all of that. Did you want to say anything more, Annie, about our interview with Frank and the response there too?
I mean, no, other than thanks you guys for listening. Thanks to all the new listeners that may be listening now because they, you know, saw Frank's podcast. I hope you climb aboard our ship and join us.
Yeah. But you're all very, very welcome. And yeah, we're just really excited that so many people enjoyed that as much as we did. I mean, we knew it was pretty awesome and exciting. And so I was just so happy that everybody else got the same experience that we did. So it's the awesome thing about a podcast. So thanks, everyone, for tweeting us as always. Tweet us at every opportunity that you have at XFD Podcast. About any episode, and we love hearing from you guys about anything to do with the X-Files. So thanks, guys.
Mulder, the internet is not good for you.
All right, Jen. So, you know, back to our bread and butter here, so to speak, right?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
We are going back into the mythology, continuing with our mythology rewatch, and we discussed including these episodes, not because they're technically mythology episodes. We're going to be talking about Fallen Angel and Eve. Yeah. But because they have elements, wouldn't you say, that sort of even thematically carry throughout the end of the series, even into the revival, which I think is pretty impressive. And, you know, again, I feel like every single time we have these mythology conversations, I'm going to have to sit down and I feel like I'm going to have to give everyone a disclaimer. Like, I'm not saying that they thought of all of this stuff back in season one because they've said multiple times that they didn't. And so we don't need to be defending it for that reason. Like, I was just having a conversation with my husband about this and how he was talking about how, like, why do people always ask, like, oh, did you have that planned? Oh, did you have that planned? That's not how television works. Like, I'm always just kind of like frustrated by that because I'm like, why does it matter what was planned? Like, what matters is, does it have a cohesiveness? Does it follow through? Does it harken back? These are all the things that, as you're creating a television show, matter. And I feel like, well, it's obvious when they wrote Eve, they weren't thinking about all of the things that were to come with Scully, for example. It still is kind of frighteningly weird to watch it now, knowing all of the things that we know to come. And that's just really good television. That's really good creating of a television show. I mean, regardless of whether or not they have a show Bible, regardless of whether or not they remembered the birth date of so-and-so or whatever, we're never going to know the truth about that. But I feel like these sorts of things that matter kind of carry through. It's interesting. And I feel like the more that we go through this mythology, the more we're going to see that.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that's a really, really good point. It's a really interesting question to me, this idea of like intent, like what was something intended to be foreshadowing, even if it looks a lot like foreshadowing from the outside, does it not count if it wasn't intentional? And I think there's an argument to be made, as you are doing, that it doesn't really matter what the intent is. Yeah. Does it work as foreshadowing? Yes. And whether it was intended to be or not, whether it was sort of a happy accident, whether it was something that like was lurking in the back of Chris Carter's mind and just came out in later seasons, who knows? Does it matter? Probably not. I mean, I think that we kind of maybe, those of us that are not involved in television in any respect, have this kind of fantasy of like the perfectly produced show where someone is sitting around thinking about 9, 11, 25 years of a show and planning it all out. And we just love that idea.
Yeah.
And because there is this through story, which was incredibly ambitious, and we kind of have this sort of like belief and dream that it was all intentional and all done with every step planned like 9 years in advance, which clearly is not realistic. Mm-mm. But I think that sometimes we just have to learn to let go of the fantasy and not to worry about that stuff. Let's not worry about what was intentional, what wasn't. Let's deal with the material as it is and make of it what we wish.
Exactly. I mean, like I said, I always say, I don't go with what I hear behind the scenes or what the intent was, whatever. I go with what I see. What I have on my screen is what I have to deal with. And that's what I need. That's what I need to make sense of the story that I'm watching. Like, not, you know, like you said, intent. Like, the idea that there are so many moving parts to creating a television show that most people aren't aware of. Like, when we're sitting here at home in our house, in our comfy couch, and we're watching the show, it's just one of us. It's just me. And I'm thinking, hey, well, I could have handled that and that and that and that. Yeah. I could have kept that all straight in my mind because I'm just me. But when you're thinking about an actual television show, it's so many moving parts, so many different people, so many balls up in the air that they have to deal with. There's all these there's these external things that go wrong, you know, like the budget, they have deadlines, they have a million different writers that scripts are due. Like, it's just, there's so many things. I'm amazed. My point is I'm amazed that they were able to keep it as cohesive as they did. Considering how long this show ran, how many people were working on it and everything. And like you said, intent, throw it away. The intent from this show was that Mulder and Scully were never, ever going to be a romantic couple. And we can throw that intent into the garbage, right? Like, that obviously changed. I mean, we heard from Frank himself, that was never the intent. It's just something that happened. And it's just something that sort of came out of the show. And that's I think that's the most perfect example of this, honestly, of that you just kind of have to go with the flow, sort of let the show evolve the way it's going to evolve. And if you can hearken back to things, great. That being said, let's move into Fallen Angel, which is season 1, episode 10. Directed by Larry Shaw, and the writers are Howard Gordon and Alex Gansa. They did a lot of season 1, right? Quite a few season 1 episodes.
They did a fair
episodes.
Bit. Yeah. Yeah, Gordon and Gansa seemed like really common names back then.
Yeah.
Sort of the way Morgan and Wong became sort of standout names later on, Gordon and Gansa were very much common names to see pop up back then.
Yeah, I don't remember so much the director names, but I feel like there were lots and lots of different directors in these early seasons. So only later did it sort of kind of fall into the hands of the same guys over and over again, which is interesting. But this is where we are. This is kind of, in my opinion, like a follow-up to Deep Throat in a way.
It's
like a similar type of story, like but it's combining what we learned in the pilot and Deep Throat. Like, we're talking about the government tech and the cover-ups, and we're also talking about real alien abductions. And it's sort of starting to combine these two worlds into like one episode, which I think is really cool. Did you kind of get the same thing from that?
Yeah, absolutely. It was very much a similar vibe from the pilot and Deep Throat, sort of like you'd say, exact same issues. But yeah, sort of like starting to bring those strands together a little bit more already, which is great. I wrote down that my favorite version of the X-Files is the forest and UFOs, which is what we have here, which is also a lot like the pilot and a lot like Requiem later on. A lot of the visual imagery in Fallen Angel reminded me a lot of Requiem.
Like,
because we have like a lot of, you know, the scenes of, you know, the sort of the lasers and the sort of whatever that sort of stuff is in the forest, trying to sort of, you know, delineate things with lasers and things like that. It reminded me so much of Requiem. So that imagery is very similar and very cool. And I always love that kind of stuff. And Mulder running around in a leather jacket's never a bad sight either.
No, that isn't. I wanted to say too, you were talking about Requiem. I should bring this up. The whole idea that when Max at the end is getting, we'll talk about Max in a second, but is getting abducted, or at least the ship is trying to abduct him. It's so similar to what happens to Scully in Requiem. Like, when they pick him up and they're he's like vibrating in the air. It's the same exact action. I mean, it's not something
that
I would ever really remember. Like, I wouldn't make that connection, but like, because, you know, we've got the red lasers, we've got the UFO, the crash, they're hiding it. These people are like cleaning it up. Like, there's such a cool, there's a lot of cool stuff going on in this episode. And I kind of forget about this one. I really do.
I know it kind of falls, pun intended, through the cracks a little bit. in season one, but maybe because it's a standalone episode, it's kind of stuck in the middle of the season. We tend to remember the pilot and Deep Throat, and we don't tend to remember Fallen Angel as much because we've also got EBE coming as well. So there's a couple of sort of UFO-oriented episodes in season one, but this is a solid episode. This really sort of like gives a nice solid foundation for a lot of the kind of UFO stories, and it's a good one. I mean, this is like, you know, X-Files at its best for me, where it's all about UFOs and government conspiracies. So yeah. I love all that stuff. I think it's awesome. And the fact that, you know, we can point to Requiem in season seven and see all the similarities.
Yep.
With maybe a little more budget. I mean, the special effects are a little different in Requiem, aren't they?
Yeah.
But the concepts are incredibly similar. And I love that. Love that, because this is it in its sort of nascent stage. And it's all there. Like, I mean, as you've said before, it's all there from the beginning. And I think Fallen Angel is a very nice microcosm of a lot of what's going on, especially in season one, with plot and with character as well. So it's a really strong episode. Don't overlook it.
Yeah, it really, and it's kind of a good sort of standalone-ish episode. Like I've never really thought about it that way before, but like I feel like I could pluck this out of season one and show it to someone who's never seen the show before, and they would probably be like, okay, I get it. You know, everything is there. All of the plot that you need is there, and the Mulder Scully dynamic that you need to see is there. So I think it's really great. I was gonna ask you a question. Let's talk about Deep Throat first for a little bit.
Okay.
Because we still have 10 episodes in Mulder not telling Scully about Deep Throat and going off on his own, ditching Scully. I mean, he does that for seasons. He does that forever. But I wanted to hear your take on this, because I feel like I don't think it has to do with trust. Like, I feel like I don't think it has to do with not trusting her even a little bit. I think maybe he still feels a little guilty for not warning her about the risks that Deep Throat warned him about back in Deep Throat. And you know, she's in it now. We're 10 episodes in, and however many months in, like, she's in it now. So maybe he just feels, maybe it's like out of guilt. But then later in Eve, and we'll talk about this when he meets up with Deep Throat again in Eve, he asks Mulder immediately, did she follow you?
Yeah.
Which then made me wonder, oh, is Deep Throat telling Mulder to not tell Scully?
Yeah, that's definitely the implication there, I think.
You think so? Is that kind of your take that, like,
that's kind of the take. Certainly in Eve, that's certainly the motivation. What it is at the point of Fallen Angel, it's hard to say. I like the idea of Mulder would like to have brought Scully in on this and didn't, out of respect for, hey, whatever your source wants, your source gets. And your source wants to just deal with you.
Right.
Keep it on the down low, just between the two of us. Maybe Deep Throat doesn't trust Scully. Mulder trusts Scully, but Deep Throat doesn't. And at that point. So I like that idea. I think that to a certain extent, I kind of get the feeling that Mulder kind of expects Scully to think that Deep Throat is full of shit and to sort of maybe would give Mulder a hard time for even talking to him.
Right.
And so maybe, like, to avoid that conversation with Scully to a certain extent, he's just kind of like, yeah, I'll just do this myself. Leave her out of it. She doesn't need to know where this stuff comes from. I don't want to get into an argument about this. I know that this is valuable information, and I don't particularly want to have to defend it. So I'm just going to do this on my own for a variety of reasons. That's just my headcanon of how I interpreted it.
Yeah, I agree with that. And I think that it is yet again another example of the idea of Scully, or of Mulder hiding things from Scully, being perfectly in character. Because we get it. We get it right off the top. It doesn't mean he doesn't trust her. I think it just, he has all kinds of reasons for hiding these things. Yep. It's like, obviously, like, later when we'll get to this in season four, but when he finds the OVA and hides that from her. I mean, I think at that point they've developed this relationship where he just doesn't want to cause her pain, you know? And it's sort of like I don't want to say like a masculine thing, because it could just be a friend thing. Like, I just don't want my friend to hurt. But like, I think that it evolves, but it's always there. It's always in the background with Mulder. Like, he has these things that he's like, I'm just going to do this on my own. I'm just going to go off on my own.
Yeah.
I don't want to involve you. Which I find interesting that we get that really, really early.
Yeah, I think that he just has a tendency. That's maybe just his default mode. Having kind of been an only child. Obviously, after Samantha was abducted, I feel like he was a very independent child, probably. I mean, I don't think his parents were exactly terrific. So no. I think he's just used to operating on his own. We don't get a sense that he has a whole lot of people in his life to support him. And so he's just used to doing things on his own. He's not used to the idea of sharing everything with someone else. To him, it probably seems weird and complicated and scary. And it's just, it's just more efficient from his perspective. I'm just going to do this on my own because that's just the way I'm used to functioning. And right. So that's kind of the way I look at it a lot of the time. It just, sometimes I think it just doesn't occur to him to share with Scully, and he's just not sure it's worth it. And for him, it's just simpler. To him, it's simpler not to.
Right.
And it's not a terribly unusual attitude from men especially, but certainly not entirely men. But I certainly have met a lot of guys who are like that, that are just kind of like, I'm going to do this on my own. It's not because I don't trust you. It's not because I'm trying to control the situation or anything. It's just that's what the way I'm comfortable operating because, you know, that's just easier for me.
He's used to it. Yeah. He's been used to that at work as well.
Like, exactly.
Presumably the past several years, he's not been taken as seriously as he may like to be or doesn't care. Yep. You never know. But he's just he's used to being the lone wolf, which we get. So I can forgive him that. I just will never, ever say that it's like out of character for him to do that.
No, this is very much his inclination.
Yeah.
His first thought is always to do things on his own, I think. And it just, he has to think twice. I think he needs to be reminded, hey, there's someone else here, but right. I think it's not the first thing that pops into his head. The first thing that popped into his head is always to do it on his own. So thank goodness Scully was, you know, she hung in there and was never put off, it seems, by, you know, Mulder's independent streak. She was mildly annoyed at times when he ditched her, but like she seemed ready to forgive him every time he did something like that.
It seemed more like a roll of the eyes kind of thing, like that's just him, he's just off doing it again, which is funny. She did that in Deep Throat, like it was like right off the bat she was like, all right, we know this is the dynamic. I wanted to give a shout out to Mark Snow for using one of my favorite cues, UFO technology, from Deep Throat in this episode. I was listening to it and I was like, that's my favorite, and it just kind of filled me
with the
light.
That this is the first time I recognized that piece of music, because we had done it on our podcast episode about music. I had never really noticed that music before, and I certainly had noticed it in this episode, but I'm like, I know that. Mm-hmm. So cool. I mean, I like to think of it now as like that's like the season one UFO theme or something like that. It's a great theme.
I love it.
The music, season one is amazing. And the music in both of these episodes we're talking about today it's all terrific, actually. I really loved the music in both of them. So, as always, Mark Snow, always.
I was going to ask you a question before we talk about Max, because I think that's a good idea to get into. What's your take on these sort of invisible entities that are sort of escaping and like, I mean, are those the aliens? Like, are we supposed to believe those are the aliens and they're like running at you like a gremlin? Like, I don't know. I feel like,
good question.
I feel like that's one of the things in this episode that that we don't see again, maybe like a red herring sort of thing that they were trying that out. And they're like, we don't need to go back to that. That could be. But did you have any take on that?
It was certainly the first thing that popped into my head was, what a imaginative way to really save on your budget. Like the creature of the week is like a little blob on like sort of heat seeking radar kind of thing. Like, good for you.
Yeah.
But it's still scary and sinister. And we only ever see the results with the soldiers, with these like horrible sort of, I guess, radiation burns or something like that. So, I interpreted those as alien creatures of some kind. In what form, who knows? But, you know, it was very much at the stage of the X-Files where we don't see anything.
Right.
We don't know. We don't really know what form they were even in, whether they were, you know, were they walking on two legs? Who knows? They just look like a blob. And that is kind of cool and awesome. And all we know is that they seem to like give off like some kind of like powerful radiation of some kind that's like causing these terrible burns. And it was cool and kind of scary and interesting. And it was just a great example of the X-Files early seasons having not a lot of money, but really like just taking what could have been something that was a difficult challenge and turning it into a benefit, really. So I thought they did it really well.
Yeah, I agree. And I wanted to bring up the radiation because that's yet another element that we come back to over and over and over again. I mean, it all the way down, like we get that in, I think, Piper Maru and Apocrypha. Mm-hmm. And I think that, like, I mean, obviously, like, I think it has something to do with Scully getting cancer. Like, I feel like there's all kinds of things. Then there's, like, the galactic radiation way later in Biogenesis. This is another element right off the top that we have that continues through and is consistent with the aliens, which I just wanted to point that out.
One of those sort of ingredients. It's like all of the, like, ingredients for the recipe are coming together here in season one, and that the radiation is another one of the ingredients to make the delicious cake that is the X-Files mythology.
Oh, I love it. I love it. Mm. Max Fennec. Let's talk about Max, played by Scott Bellis. Mm. And we get him back later, obviously, in
way later, really. Like quite a bit later.
Yeah. So, season four, Tempest, Fugit, and Max. And he's really, it's funny. He's a really cool character because I like the fact that he doesn't seem to really know what's going on. It's like he believes in something, but it's like it's not the right thing. And Mulder's sort of, you know, like Mulder's sort of figuring out, like, he doesn't even think he's been abducted. But, like, that's, like, the weirder explanation. But, like, it's also maybe the truth, I love the idea that there's all these different, like, Scully's kind of getting on board with the idea that, okay, there's shady government shit going on. They're covering stuff up. I can see it happening. But I still don't see the evidence of the alien stuff. Like, I'm not seeing that. You're making that up, Mulder. But it's like, I feel like Max is the same way. It's like he wants to believe and there's evidence right there in him, but he doesn't see it, which I think is really cool. And then later, by the time we see him again in season four, he's changed quite a bit. And it's interesting because at the end of this, he, you know, apparently he's abducted. He's gone. Mm. Yeah. But don't they say that they, like, found his body in a dumpster? But, like, it's probably, like, a fake. I would think it's, like, a government fake body. Like, this, like,
I'm assuming that's a fake, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, and I thought about it more, and I'm like, well, he's back, but we don't know he's back. And then later, he obviously is back. So it makes me wonder if he's really abducted for this entire time, or what's going on with Max, Jen? Like, what do you think?
Who knows? I think that's a really great point about how he is, like, sort of, you know, like a conspiracy nut. He comes along before we meet the lone gunman, but he's of that ilk. Mm-hmm. And you know, really into all these different things, and obviously loves talking to Mulder about it. Has followed Mulder's career. It's all really fun. But yeah, it's so interesting that he's really into all this stuff. But it's like right under his nose. He is the one that's in the middle of all of this.
Yeah.
He's being abducted, and for some reason, he doesn't see that. He doesn't get that. It doesn't occur to him for whatever reason. Mm-hmm. And it's such an interesting bit of sort of dialogue between Mulder and Scully, where Mulder says something like, you don't understand, Scully. It's not that Max thinks he's being abducted. I think he's being abducted.
Yeah.
Because Scully's, you know, explanation is that, you know, Max is psychotic, and so this is part of his delusions, which is, you know, a fair theory based on the medication he's on.
Right.
But Mulder says, no, he doesn't. It's not a delusion because he doesn't actually believe this.
And to Scully's credit,
has put this together.
To Scully's credit, she doesn't, like, connect the dots and then accuse Mulder of being psychotic. So
Yeah, maybe she could have just, you know, just taken a slight swerve and said, okay, well,
all right,
maybe not his psychosis, yours. Okay.
Yeah.
But yeah. No,
I love that.
But that's it's a very interesting twist, isn't it? Because it would have been very obvious for him to say, you know, to make these claims, I've been abducted, and to sound like, you know, an abduction nut or whatever. And for that to sort of be the central story of his character. But it's not. He's not claiming anything to have happened to him, except something actually is happening to him. So it's very interesting. I love Max. I think he's such an interesting character. So well played, so well written. I feel really bad for him whenever I see him. He seems like a very sad character. He's got like a lot of, he seems to have like a really sort of like optimistic, upbeat, positive outlook. But yet his life is a bit tragic. And so I always really feel for him.
Yeah, it seems a bit lonely. Like, I mean, I feel like you brought up the lone gunman, which was a good comparison, as I feel like Scully sees guys like this and thinks, wow, what a lonely life. You know what I mean? Like, there's no one else that you can share this with because everyone thinks you're crazy, you know, and like the lone gunmen are lucky to have found each other, but they're stuck down in a basement just like Mulder is, you know, and it just makes it doesn't surprise me. Like, again, not, you know, I always have to bring this back around to the ship that Scully doesn't probably consider him boyfriend material for quite a while. I mean, we know this as much from Jersey Devil when she's like, he's obsessed with his work. Like, she wants to get on that. We know because she thinks he's cute.
Yeah, she knows.
but she knows it's not a good idea. Like,
She's like, he's not the guy for me.
Exactly.
And because she looks at someone like Max, and I think even in like Tempest Fugit or Max, she does make a bit of a comparison between Max and Mulder, just very in passing. And yeah, to her, there's maybe not a huge difference between Mulder and Max. And at that point, there isn't a huge difference between Mulder and Max. The only real difference is that Mulder has somehow landed a government job to be able to do all this stuff.
Right.
But if not for that, he would be Max for sure. They definitely speak the same language. And so, yeah, to Scully, there's not a huge difference. And so, she's not really into that.
No offense to Max, but Mulder, no one is quite as dreamy as Mulder. So there's that as well.
Yeah, no, Max is definitely my type, but I don't think he's necessarily Scully's type. But yeah, I love the nerdy guys.
He's not a bad looking guy, but
he's not a bad looking guy. And I just think there's something very adorable about him.
Mulder, you put anyone next to Mulder.
I know. No one can compete with Mulder. The hotness is off the scale. Stand back. I'm getting radiation burns.
Oh, nice one. Nice one. Bringing it around. I did want to bring up the idea because I feel like Mulder and Scully they're running on all cylinders in this episode in terms of their dynamic. It's great. Mm. It's fabulous. But at the same time, it's frustrating. And like, I can see even this early on, they know what each other are about. And there's this sort of constant push pull that I can see how frustrating it is for both of them to be around each other. It's like, you know, you want to think that everything is happy and roses and all the time. But I'm like, I can see how these two people are probably always constantly slightly irritated with each other, which is like, it's essentially like a married couple that aren't married.
Yeah.
Like, and it's like, they're like work wives. They really are. And it's like, they can't ever get away from each other. And they also have this constant teensy little bit of irritation paired with this overwhelming sexual attraction that they can't deny. It's just, it's a recipe for extended unresolved sexual tension is all I'm saying.
I can see why
it took so long. That's all I'm saying. I can see it right off the top.
Absolutely. It is. And like they're not seeing each other at a 9-to-5 job either. They're taking flights together. They're driving across country together. I mean, there's a certain natural conflict between them because of the people that they are and the beliefs that they have and the personalities that they have. And I don't think you could spend that much time with someone that is ever so slightly irritating unless you were madly in love with them, which is why married people can do it.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's like, yes, you annoy each other, but at the end of the day, you love each other, so you can put up with that crap. And so that's the only way that Mulder and Scully put up with each other. They may not have realized it at the time, but you only put up with that amount of irritation from someone over that long a period of time that frequently because you love them and because everything else about them makes up for that.
Absolutely. And I mean,
it's definitely, you know, quite clear in this episode.
She does choose it. I mean, and I say Mulder doesn't really have a choice, but like she chooses it over and over again. And it's
she really does. And this episode kind of further emphasizes that. Really throughout season one, that's very much Scully's sort of story in season one, is going from someone who naturally is, you know, respects authority, respects the government. You know, she kind of buys the story about the Libyan jet. And she's there on her assignment, as she says it, is to bring Mulder back to Washington. She's there on assignment. She's been sent to retrieve him. Mm-hmm. Go get your boy and bring him back.
Yep.
And that's what she's there for at the beginning of the episode. But I think this episode is great because it almost it's like a microcosm of Scully's arc really throughout the series, really.
Yeah.
Which is, you know, at the beginning of the episode, she's all, You know, you're full of crap, Mulder. I'm here to bring you back. This is not a UFO. But, you know, Scully, her default mode is to trust authority, but she's always open to hearing evidence to the contrary. She never digs in her heels. She never says, nope, I'm not listening. She always listens. She might be skeptical, but she listens. And, you know, by the end of the episode, she's like, she's defying the military in the hospital when she gets to be like a badass doctor in the ER. And she's like trying to hold off the military when they're trying to catch Mulder and Max at the end. She really becomes quite defiant.
Yeah.
And in the hearing at the end as well. So it's a really cool arc for her within just within this episode in terms of going from, you know, I'm here to bring you back to, okay, I'm here to stand by your side and fight with you. And I love that.
You know, it's interesting that you bring that up. I have to bring this up just because this was on my mind today, especially there was a conversation that we were having on Twitter about the type of men that Scully is attracted to. And this, yes, this all completely tracks with like her type of like, okay,
yep,
some authority figure that she, yep, wants to challenge. And I mean, that's, yeah, the exact, that's the history that we see with all the men that we learn that she's been, or the men that she shows interest in. It's always this sort of, I'm going to say, quote unquote, father figure, but this authority figure that she, yeah, then wants to challenge. It's like a turn, yeah, on for her. It's like out of, yeah, her wheelhouse. And it's just funny how that translates over to her work, like, yeah, the way she works and the way, yeah, she, her belief systems is. I just thought that was interesting that you just said, yeah, that, and I'm like, it does really track with her character. That's really,
it really does. That is obviously like a very big foundation of her personality.
Yeah,
in all ways, work and romance. Mm-hmm. It's there. That kind of respect yet desire to challenge.
Yes, yes.
Authority. It's sort of, it's
willingness
to willingness, yeah, to, yeah, and it sounds a bit like it would be in conflict, but you know, she's a complex human being, and they show that throughout the series and very consistently, and, mm-hmm, we see it definitely in this episode, and I think it's very cool. I love the way she's tough, and she wants to do things by the book, but she's not stubborn about it, and,
right,
she's willing to listen to Mulder no matter how crazy he sounds. She might be skeptical. She might go into it not expecting much out of the conversation, but she, at the end of the day, will listen. And,
right,
she doesn't necessarily believe everything he says, but she at least listens and takes it all into account within her own belief system. And I think that's great. I mean, really, that's so key to their dynamic between Mulder and Scully, that Scully always remains Scully. She's skeptical Scully. She's science Scully, but she also listens, and she's willing to hear other points of view and she respects those points of view, which is great.
Yeah, I feel like the characters are really well formed from the beginning, and they did a really good job of doing that. But I feel like Jillian kind of finds Scully later, like maybe like around season three is, I feel like, when she really sort of finds Scully, like this is the character that this is going to be Scully. I feel like the first couple seasons, she's very much, she's a little more authoritative. I can't say that right. Mm. But like, I also kind of get the idea that, you know, Mulder maybe softens her a little bit, but also the fact that she's coming into this job as sort of a woman operating in a man's world. And so I kind of enjoy seeing that. From the beginning, she's such a strong character, and she's just very, she's not going to take shit from Mulder. Like, she's going to, yep, be like, look, I'm not going to get pushed around. This is what we need to be doing. Yep. And I really appreciate seeing that. But I feel like that softened as the seasons went on a little bit. Mm-hmm. And I think that's the character. But I also think that was Jillian sort of finding, you know, the happy medium of where Scully needs to be in that regard, which,
yeah, yeah,
I think is a good thing. But I think it makes total sense at the beginning. So I like seeing that.
Yeah. 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 I definitely see it as like a character growth kind of thing. When you go back and watch these season one episodes, she does seem quite different. I think you're right that from about maybe season three onward, she doesn't change as much in that way. By the time she gets to that point, she's like fully on Mulder's side.
Yeah. I mean,
in these early episodes, she's trying to walk the line. She's, mm-hmm, she can't really at the end of the day, but she's trying to find a way, if it's possible, to walk some kind of a line between being faithful to Mulder, loyal to Mulder, and at the same time trying to do her job as she sees it's meant to be done in terms of respecting authority and that sort of thing. And so she's trying to figure out how to do that. She still thinks she might be able to do both. But in the end, she just winds up kind of flipping back and forth because there's no way to do both at the same time. But she's trying. She's trying to figure it out, I think. And I think at some point she says, you know, fuck this shit. I'm just going to kind of pretend to respect authority, but I'm really not going to. But at this point, she genuinely does.
Right. I think that at the end of this episode, there's a really good scene, the one where she's at the table. And it's an unusual scene for the X-Files where she's sitting at that long table and she looks so small, and like these big government guys are at the other end and they're reprimanding her, and it really kind of drives home the position that she's in, at least to me watching the show at this point. Like, okay, she's definitely the one who is supposed to be there reining Mulder in, you know, giving the reports, doing everything the right way, but she is she is being pushed, like you said, both ways. And she tries to defend him in that scene. It's like she really, really tries. And Mulder doesn't really get to see that. And I think he knows that that she's defending him in there. But it does. I think that shot did a really good job of sort of really laying bare the spot that Scully is in, especially because I feel like around this time in the season, people were getting kind of frustrated with Scully. I remember hearing about that because I know Beyond the Sea was probably coming up soon, right? Because they decided to make us an episode where they softened her a bit. But I think that scene at the end, I just wanted to bring it up with McGrath and the FBI people, is just a really good, a good way to visually convey that. I really liked that. Yeah. And I also want to talk about Mulder for a second. His speech at the end when he goes into that room reminded me a lot of his speech in The Truth. I had like The Truth vibes because it was very like he says like no government agency has jurisdiction over the truth, which is like very much like his finale speech. And I just
it was nice. I love that. Yeah, I love that line. It's just it's classic Mulder and classic X-Files. And, you know, anytime they get to mention The Truth, capital T, I love it. So it's a really great point, too, about how that scene was shot with all of the FBI guys down one end of the table and poor little Scully all alone down the other end and this kind of like long shot of her. Very cool point. And, you know, I feel like she cares more about trying to protect Mulder than Mulder cares about protecting himself.
Yes.
He's very much like, I give up.
Yep.
You know, I had a good run. This was bound to happen kind of thing. Scully seems way more upset about it than Mulder does. If, you know, Mulder would be completely a mess without Scully making some attempt to look out for him, because he's got no interest in looking out for himself. He seems very sort of fatalistic that it's just a matter of time before the X-Files closes. And, oh, well, shoulder shrug, we gave it a go. But Scully is much more determined. Like, she is not going to let those X-Files close. She's on that case way more than Mulder is.
But I feel like also he's used to this. Like he's used to getting away with this because we don't know yet, but there's someone looking out for him. Someone with a cigarette who is not going to let him get thrown out of the FBI. And so I almost feel like Mulder has had these conversations so many times at this point that he's just like, well, you know, if this is it, this is it. If not, whatever, I'll probably be working still tomorrow. Like, I feel like he's genuinely not worried about losing his job. You know what I mean? Like every time he goes into one of these meetings, he thinks it could probably go either way. But I wouldn't call it, like, I know you said fatalistic. I wouldn't really call it that because I feel like I think he wants to keep doing this. He's just, he has to do what he has to do, you know, to get there. And if that means getting fired, he's going to keep looking for the truth. You know, it doesn't really matter. Yeah. It doesn't matter if he's doing it from the FBI or not, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. The FBI is just a means to an end for him. He doesn't care about becoming the assistant director in the FBI. Scully's much more interested in her career within the FBI than Mulder is. And I think that's a really good point that he probably has gone through this before, and it's like, well, you can't get worked up every single time it happens,
or else
you'll just be exhausted.
Exactly.
So at some point, you just got to kind of go with it and say, hey, it's out of my control. So, you know, whatever happens, happens. I'm just rolling with it.
But it's all still new
to Scully, and she's all like, oh my God, they might fire you and shut down the X-Files. And Mulder's like, yeah, what else is new?
Yeah, exactly. And then we get a really good, we won't be talking about this in the mythology episodes, but we get a really good indication of that later in Tombs, your favorite scene, when they have their, Jen's giving me the googly eyes, when they have their conversation about how she's reached the point where she's ready to put herself on the line for him, you know?
Yes.
She's not there yet, you know? And it's nice to see that sort of, that arc happen.
That's a key thing when she wouldn't put herself on the line for anybody but him. At this point, she kind of puts herself on the line. You know, she's being a little bit sort of snotty to the big chiefs at the FBI when they're having that discussion at the end. So she puts herself out a little more than I think she's normally comfortable. I think she puts herself slightly out of the comfort zone, but she's not quite ready to totally put herself out there yet. But this is, you know, she's just easing herself into that idea.
Oh, definitely. Definitely.
She's getting there.
Yeah. And I love it. I think season one is just such a really nice.
Love season one.
It's a really nice arc. And I often forget. It gets lost. It's a great season. There are a couple.
Yeah, it's a great season. I mean, there's so many shows that the first season is like, nope, don't watch the first one. They really didn't know what they were doing.
Right.
But man, it's really strong from the very beginning. And, you know, this is just one example. You know, I think it was a really good point that you made about how this has like all of the X-File ingredients present. This would not be a bad episode to be a first episode to show to somebody because it does have all of those key points, almost more than the pilot or Deep Throat. Either one of those would be great first episodes, obviously. But I think Fallen Angel might be, if I had to pick one to show to someone to say, hey, this is the X-Files. This would be a pretty good one to pick, actually,
it
now
is.
That I think about it.
Yeah, because, you know, like I said, it combines both of those elements. It's,
yeah.
It's great.
Just a little bit more.
Yeah, yeah. It's like it's just building everything up, which is nice. Do you have anything else to say about Fallen Angel, or do you want to move on to Eve?
I was just going to say how interesting I found that last scene with Deep Throat, because he makes a final appearance at the end. This idea that, oh, he actually has some influence over these high guys at the FBI, that this like Section Chief McGrath guy seems to answer to Deep Throat to some extent.
Right.
So I think that's the first time we see him in that context.
Yes.
Up until then, I don't think we have any sense that he has any connection with the FBI necessarily, or influence at least.
Or yeah, even any power. I mean, I'm sure in the end it's like he's probably not, and again, we don't really ever know in terms of hierarchy where all the syndicate members lie. I mean, I assume that like the syndicate is a bunch of guys that are kind of on the same level, including Smoking Man. Like, I don't ever see Smoking Man as higher than the others. Like, I just don't. He's just one of the most cunning ones. But, like, I get the feeling that, they at this point probably didn't even really know about Smoking Man in terms of his role on the show yet. I mean,
he's not here.
No, he already exists. I mean, we know he exists. He exists.
No, but he's not in this episode.
Right. But we don't know how he is influencing Mulder. But, again, it tracks. Like you look back and you go, oh, well, now we can look back and we know why they're not killing Mulder, while they're not getting rid of Mulder. But at the time, it was probably, I mean, again, you watched this at the time. You were probably confused too. Like, why aren't they just getting rid of Mulder? This doesn't make any sense.
But I rarely question that sort of thing. So
yeah.
Just weirdly enough, I'm just kind of like, he's hot. So let's just keep watching this.
Yeah.
It didn't really occur to me, to be honest. But I do remember like with the scene with Deep Throat, thinking, wait a second, hang on. This is a bit of a twist, because up until now, he had just seemed like Mulder's buddy. And then all of a sudden, he's like, this whole, keep your friends close and keep your enemies closer. It's like, does he mean that? Who's he playing? He's either playing Section Chief McGrath or he's playing Mulder. But at that point, we really don't know which one it is. And so
it's
kind of like, woo, or it's both, of course.
Yeah.
And it's kind of like, oh, this just kicked up a notch. I mean, they did so much with Deep Throat in the short, beautiful season we had him in terms of all the different sort of twists and layers to his character and his role. And that was a really interesting twist, was when, when we saw him with the Section Chief at the end there. It's like, oh, now what's going on? Hang on.
Yeah.
This has just got a little bit more interesting. So I did like that as well. So yeah, it's a very solid episode. I'm a fan of Fallen Angel for sure.
Yeah. And I mean, it actually carries on nicely into Eve, because we see Deep Throat again in Eve.
It was a strange thing for him to suddenly appear in the middle of this episode.
Right.
Oftentimes it seems like his role in the episode is structured so that he's at the beginning and or the end. He rarely makes his first appearance in the middle of the episode. So I think it's easy to forget that he's in this one. I would tend to argue that his presence alone can kind of add to the evidence of making it considered a mythology episode to some extent, because he's such a key figure in the mythology in season one, because we don't have CSM in season one in the same way we do later on, to sort of cue us into the fact that, hey, this is a mythology episode. Deep Throat to me is kind of like that guy that says, hey, pay attention, this is a mythology episode. To some extent, I think that in the context of season one, it's not really mythology because it doesn't fit in with UFOs in any way. But I think that with some of the themes that I'm sure we'll talk about in later seasons, looking back on Eve, it looks more like a mythology episode than it did at the time.
Right.
Because at the time, the mythology seems strictly to do with UFOs.
Right.
But we learn, of course, later on that it has a broader mandate than that. And that's where Eve fits in.
I think the idea, too, that when the mythology really gets going, and we'll talk about that when we get up to the Duane Barry arc, and they have Scully's abduction, and that's when they really start playing around with the experimentation and the genetic eugenics and, you know, medical rapists and all of that stuff that is essentially creating babies, like creating life forms and creating clones and creating, like, this is all stuff, though, that I feel like for the first time we're seeing in Eve. Especially since Deep Throat's the one delivering the information about the Litchfield's experiments and about what was going on and what has been going on for decades. The idea of these experimentations on innocent people is something that I feel like this is maybe the first time in the season we're hearing about that. And that is definitely part of the X-Files, even in... interweaved with the alien mythology. While this is not technically alien mythology, it's sort of like you said, like paving the way for that we're going to be getting that. Like, this is a part of the show. This is a plot point of the show.
Major one. It becomes much more major later on. It's easy to overlook it early. I mean, you know, certainly back in season one, it didn't occur to me that this had any connection to the mythology because there's no aliens.
Right.
But as we learned that, you know, it can still be connected to aliens. It just wasn't connected to aliens yet because we're putting the ingredients into our delicious mythology cake. And this was another ingredient, was the idea of reproductive technology. And it hasn't been tied in with aliens yet. But that's okay. That would be maybe way too much at first. And it's just part of what will become a bigger whole later. And so we're just learning about it sort of separately on its own. We have to learn this stuff in itself before we can start to see the connections between them. So Fallen Angel and Eve are an interesting pair in that sense, I think, because Fallen Angel is all about the UFO side and the sort of that side of the government conspiracy. And Eve is all about sort of reproductive technology and that side of the government conspiracy. Mm-hmm. Government conspiracies sort of join both episodes together thematically. But they also turn out to be two sort of major sort of arms of the mythology. We just didn't realize it at the time.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think it's interesting to note that Deep Throat, I'm sure you noticed this, he literally says superior soldier.
Yeah, I had never noticed it until just this week when I rewatched that episode. I mean, I've seen Eve quite a few times, but for some reason, I had never picked up on the fact that he actually literally says the word superior soldier.
Yeah.
And I'm like, holy shit. Did he just say super soldier, sort of?
Yeah. And I mean, again, it's like everyone always gives season 9 a bunch of shit for not making sense. And I agree with you. I think that I can agree with a lot of people when they say that, but it's the super soldier thing. I guess what I'm trying to say is, like, it didn't come out of nowhere. The idea of creating this superior race and using alien technology to do it has been around in the show for a long time. I think that the problem with season 9 is that they didn't, at that point, they were really bad at sort of explaining the connections and making them clear. And I'm not saying that they ever really did that, but at times they did that, at least to the extent where you could sort of figure out and make the connections of, like, okay, this is a huge deal we're going to talk about. We're going to talk about these super soldiers. They're going to be such a big deal that they're going to make Mulder leave. They're going to be that big of a deal. But no, we're not going to talk about where they came from or what they are or what they do or none of that. You just have to go with it, people. And I feel like, and I did notice this the last time when I watched Eve, I watched it several months ago. I think I watched it like right after the show ended, the season 11 ended. And I saw that and I was like, what? Like, I had to like rewind it. And I was like, did he say that in season 1?
Honestly, right?
They're talking about super soldiers. I mean, it's true. And I think that it's not, I'm not saying that it's not a coincidence, because it very well may be, but I don't think that the idea of creating a superior soldier using alien technology was something that Chris Carter pulled out of his ass in season 9. That's all I'm saying.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I mean, yeah, he uses, like you say, he uses the phrase to come up with a superior soldier. And at that point, it's not in the context of alien technology, but in the context of eugenics. But it's not a leap to say, okay, to go from there to incorporating aliens into that. I mean, we're into that concept at least by season 3 and maybe sooner. Mm-hmm. So it doesn't take us long to bring that up. But yeah, we're already starting to like, okay, this is this episode. We're going to learn all about eugenics just in the human sense and how reproductive technology can be used.
They have
and
to ease
can
us
be
in.
Manipulated. They have to ease us in. And so yeah. this is us learning in a very entertaining way about different ways that the government may have screwed around with human reproduction and doing it in such a way as to make victims of these women who are being experimented on without their consent and who are giving birth to children that are not their children, are not normal children without them realizing it. That's obviously an ongoing theme.
Yes.
You know, that's obviously, I mean, this whole episode has very much a season 8 vibe, where so much of season 8 was all about, you know, Scully's fears about what is this baby that I'm carrying.
Exactly.
And that's very much what Eve is about. So we see that definitely that foundation being laid here.
Yeah, I wanted to bring that up too, because you talk about season 8, and again, there's no way at this point they were thinking about let's talk about IVF, because we're gonna have an IVF plot down the road. But I do think that there are really, really interesting parallels, especially knowing that Scully's the one talking about this. She's talking to the doctor, you know, she's asking him all these questions that she's going to have to ask herself in 8 years. You know what I mean?
That's
and
right.
it's very, very interesting to see that happening. And she's literally saying, can a woman be implanted with an ova that's not hers? She's asking all of these questions that are like, these are questions that we should have been asking in season 8. These are questions we should have been asking in season 11. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And it's super interesting to see it way back here at the beginning. Did you notice this? I wanted to say, there is a really, really freakishly brilliant shot and moment in this episode. Yeah. You probably know what I'm going to say.
I think I might know what you're going to say.
When Sally Kendricks is on the TV and she says, with a little luck and a lot of hope, miracles can happen. And we literally have the shot of Mulder and Scully together watching this.
Sitting together watching this in their like motel room.
I think. It was just, it gave me all the like, oh my God, like this is like, it's crazy. Like, again,
it's wild, isn't it?
It's wild to think about where this story went in that regard, in terms of the IVF, in terms of the never give up on a miracle, in terms of them in the motel room in Plus One talking about wanting more kids. Like, everything tracks and lines up.
It's amazing. And just the way that, like you said, the way that actual scene is shot.
Yes. It's crazy.
It's shot so that you can see Dr. Kendrick on the TV screen and you can see Mulder and Scully in the mirror behind her. So you can literally see them watching that video at that moment.
Yep.
For whatever reason, that's the way they shot that scene. And it blows my mind. I remember I noticed that before. And I love it. It's one of those things that, you know, I think it's probably just a really happy accident, but it's an amazing one. And I love it. I choose to think of that as like a really amazing piece of foreshadowing, because there's no other way to really look at that, whether it was intentional or not. To use the language, miracles can happen with Mulder and Scully right there, sitting right next to each other, it's amazing. It's amazing to see, you know, baby Scully and baby Mulder watching that and to know what they are going to go through later. It's very, very interesting. And it's just like, it's always so cool when you're watching an X-Files episode and you're like, wait a second, hang on.
Yeah.
Look at this. And to see something that you may not have noticed before because of the context of later seasons. And that's very, very cool.
I think that happens quite a bit. And again, I'm not going to say that it's intentional, but there are quite a few happy accidents like that make me think
that it's great.
On some level, they had to have known what was going on, at least.
Yeah.
And even later to sort of remember those things or not remember. I don't know what's weirder, to remember it and say, oh, hey, that's a cool parallel, or to not remember it and have it be just completely random and lucky. Like, I don't.
Yeah, they have like an accidental parallel that like you weren't even intending. Like, what were the chances then?
Both of those options, and those are the only two options, are incredible. So
they really are.
Yeah. I can't even decide. It's
yeah, I don't know. But I love it. So it's, I mean, the thing that there's a lot of things I love about the X-Files. And one of the things I love best about it is that it spans 25 years. And it initially even just spans 9 years. And to see all these different pieces of the puzzle that are scattered across those 9 and 25 years is so cool to me. And I love that.
Yeah. I wanted to point out too, just, I always like to bring up things that come back later. Like, we're talking here about they're cloning, essentially, that the cloning is happening. And then when we find out in next season with the Samantha clones, that this is something that all, you know, we don't necessarily know if it's connected. But then it also made me think of like season 10 in Founders Mutation, when they're talking about creating the perfect genetic specimen, you know, and then again, that travels on through William, and like all of these things that just continually, it just slowly grows and evolves, and little seeds get planted along the way. And I just think it's really great. It's really great.
Yeah. Yeah. It's very, very cool. There's a lot going on in Eve. Once you view it in the context of the later seasons, there's like, whoa, you can't help but see it in the context of the mythology. Certainly, you know, way back in season one, it was just kind of a monster of the week that for some reason Deep Throat shows up in. But now looking back on it, I see it in a totally different way, and it's very cool and very interesting. It's a really great episode too.
Yeah.
It's just really well paced, well written. Those two little girls scare the shit out of me. They were in my like top 10 baddies list. So you know how I feel about them. And, you know, the adult Eves are she's an incredible actress as well. So everything about it is just really, really well done. And it's a great episode.
We should give her a shout out. Harriet Harris. She's great.
All right. Harriet Harris. She's amazing.
And the girls are Erica and Sabrina Crevens, which we've already given them a shout out to. But they're
love
great.
Them. They are so creepy. I can't.
They really are.
Can't stop being frightened of them every time I watch the episode. So it's a really, really solid episode. And I also want to give credit to Scully for being right when Mulder was wrong in a couple of different ways. Because first, Mulder is wrong when he thinks that UFOs are involved. He thinks that there's abduction and exsanguination going on, cattle mutilation, all that stuff. Nothing to do with it. Nothing whatsoever, as it turns out. And later on, Mulder also says, oh, it's like it's the Eves that are going around committing these murders so that they can get the young girls into their group. And Scully says, oh, well, you know, for a second there, I was starting to suspect the girls. And Mulder's like, no.
Yeah. You're right.
Mulder's wrong again. And Scully is right. So I just want to say, good for you, Scully. You are smart chickadee.
Every time that happens, I feel like we need to like do a tally mark, check mark, because it happens so rarely for Scully.
Right?
Yeah, she didn't get to rewrite very often, but
she did not, and she totally could have rubbed it in his face later on in the episode, and to her credit, does not. But I'm going to rub it in his face on her behalf. So I just wanted to do that.
You know, it's funny, to both of their credit, more to Mulder since he's right more. He doesn't do that. Like he doesn't.
No, he does.
He doesn't. And I want to say, because I have, as you do, I'm sure, an encyclopedic, ridiculous knowledge of the show, I can point to episode Field Trip in season 6 as the only time that I can think of in terms of him verbally losing his patience with Scully and saying, I'm right 9 times out of 10. Or he says something like that, like 98.9% of the time, who turns out to be right? Like, and I remember in that episode, him saying that to her and me thinking, whoa, Mulder, holy shit. But at the same time, I'm like, well, you're right. And I mean, it was like, it was it was one of those moments where I'm like, he'd just gotten fed up. He's like, no, we're not doing this time. We're not doing this time. And I just think it was just it was sort of a funny example of, you know what? He's allowed to rub it in her face every once in a while. And the fact that I think on record, he only does it one time. I could be wrong.
Yeah.
is pretty admirable. So
yeah, the fact that that stands out is that's a really good thing, because honestly, he could practically do it every week. So yeah,
he could if he wanted to.
It's very respectful that you know, he still listens to Scully and still respects her opinion, even though really he is right most of the time. Mm-hmm. But they still keep that balance. It always feels like at any moment Scully could definitely be right. So,
and you know,
I never sort of felt like, oh well, Mulder's always going to be right, even though he pretty much always was. I should have figured it out after a while, but Scully's explanations almost always seemed really reasonable to me. So I was always like, that could be true too,
right? And I think that a lot of the time that is the case, and I feel like that's where they leave it. Like, to the viewer, we know Mulder was right, but they're still left in sort of a state of uncertainty, which I think I think happens more often than we think. So it's like we know Mulder's right, but a lot of the time he can't quite claim it. I think that's probably that's probably the truth. Before, I wanted to talk about a couple cute shippy things, but I think we should end with that. But before we have to talk about the my struggle for parallels. I have a problem with a scene in this episode at the very end. You know what scene I'm talking about? This is one of those things where I watch this episode and I think, did Chris Carter write this? I actually have to check. Who wrote this episode?
The writer for this one was Kenneth Biller and Chris Brancato. And I have no idea who they are, but it's interesting to me that Chris Carter obviously was happy to let sort of other writers get their hands on a story like this back then.
Yeah. I can't then blame Chris Carter. I was totally prepared to blame him. But it really made me think the idea of this mother throwing this daughter's picture in the fire and being like, she was never my daughter. It really, really, and I don't think this was intentional, especially in considering my struggle for, but it really made me think of the last scene of my struggle for.
Yeah.
And I never thought that with Scully. Like, I really do think that we're talking about two different scenarios here. But the fact that this scene exists in Eve and is just there as hey, this is a normal reaction, makes me think that like whoever wrote this doesn't get it. Like, and I mean, I hate throwing the whole like, oh well, if you're not a parent, you don't get it, because I really feel like even if you're not a parent, you wouldn't think that that is a normal reaction, right? Like
no, I mean, I'm not a parent, and I was like, cold bitch.
Yeah.
I mean, I can understand her feeling conflicted, because not only does she find out she's not really her daughter, she also knows
she's a murderer.
As she has all along, that she murdered her husband.
Yeah.
And so I can kind of see that she would certainly feel conflicted and distressed by that. But this idea that it's just so simple for her, just wipe the hands, throw the pitcher in the fire.
Yeah,
it was a little simplistic. It was overly simplistic.
Very heavy-handed, and it was just troubling to me knowing what comes later. And I don't really want to compare the two, because even though that dialogue at the end of My Struggle for Her is terrible, like, I know what I know what Scully means when she says that, and it's a very unfortunate parallel in my mind, because I feel like that's what a lot of people think that she was doing, was essentially throwing William in the fire like that. And I don't believe that to this day.
No.
I don't believe that's what was happening there, and the reason I don't believe that is because I know Scully, and I know that that's not what Scully meant. So,
but the dialogue is very similar. That's the unfortunate part, because we have, like, you know, it's Mrs. Reardon saying, you know, she was not my daughter, she never was, and of course the dialogue you're referring to in My Struggle for, where Scully says, I was never a mother to him, talking about William, and it's clear that the meaning is quite different, but it's also easy to see how someone could see a parallel and could see, well, okay, this is what it meant. It's pretty clear what Mrs. Reardon means, and it would be easy for someone to think that Scully means the same thing. And that was just bad writing. So we shouldn't have to defend Scully as much as we have had to.
I agree with you. I think it's a bad line that was I don't even want to say misread, because there's nothing wrong with the way that she read it. But when you're dealing with adoption and you're dealing with the fact that she wasn't a mother to him, Yeah. It's what she's saying is utterly and completely true. And it's very Scully, and it's very rational for her to say that. And I can see, though, why people can take it the other way and be upset.
It's very easy. Yeah. It's very easy to take it like, you know, I was never a mother to him. He was, you know, I'm going to throw him in the fire now kind of thing. It's in the context of that scene. I can see where you would definitely take that meaning from it. That certainly was the meaning I initially took from it. And I was kind of like, what the actual fuck's happening right now? So it's something that if you have to concentrate really hard to try to divine the true meaning, then it's not great writing.
And exactly.
Yeah, definitely Gillian did her best with it, although she was probably also hampered by the fact that she did not have a lot of time to prepare those lines of dialogue, and maybe she would have delivered them differently.
I agree with that.
But yeah, we'll get to that when we eventually get to the end of our road.
Oh God, we're going to have to talk about this again and again and again.
Yeah, we are. But I can't help but think about that line when I watch this now, because it is very similar to what Scully says, but the meaning's quite different here. At least I sure hope it is.
I absolutely think it is. I really honestly don't think that I'm just like making this up. I just think it's poor writing. And I think everyone agrees it's poor writing. So that's why I can get being upset with the writing. I can't get a year later being upset thinking Scully's a terrible person and was written out of character, because I would just never think that. Like, I just don't take it that way. But you are absolutely right. I had to bring it up because it definitely made me think of that. And it just rubbed me the wrong way.
Yeah.
And it's also different too, because this is just some sort of minor character that we're never going to see again. So I'm like, oh, well, she's got issues. Okay, bye-bye, lady. Never see you again. But when it's something that is happening to Scully, we're going to think very, very differently about it. And it is eerily similar. And it would have been a disservice if we didn't bring it up. So,
fair point.
But yeah, I, to this day, I don't have a problem with my struggle scene as much as I have a problem with this Eve scene.
Well, the Eve scene, in a way, the Eve scene is what a lot of people think the My Struggle
Force scene. Oh, yeah, I know. I get it. I know.
This is intended to be interpreted this way. There's no other way around it.
She's, exactly. That's my problem with this scene.
This is clearly a non-biological mother washing her hands of her daughter in a pretty brutal fashion and very cold-hearted, with no regret whatsoever.
No.
Not a tear in her eye by the looks of things.
Yeah.
Nothing but rage towards her at this point. It's a little bit one-dimensional the way they play that. But who knows? She could be a total kook, that lady. We don't see much of her.
Exactly. So we can write her off.
Who knows what the context is of her behavior.
We can write her off because we don't know her as a person with troubles. She's got issues. She's going to need to deal with them down the road.
She's got an issue.
Right. And we know Scully doesn't have issues.
So, you know, tell with her.
Exactly.
Yeah. No. Well, not those issues, at least.
Yes.
So, yeah.
Yeah. But anyway, let's talk about like the couple little, before we wrap this episode up, there's a couple cute little shippy moments in this. And it would be remiss of us as the definitive shipper cast to not talk about these things.
Shipper cast.
First of all, the what's a girl scene. It's like the cutest thing ever. I love the idea that he gets the call. It's like the click, click, click. Or she says there's a clicking. I don't remember who answers it. And he's like,
yes, Scully says it.
He suddenly is like, up, gotta go. Yes. He's like literally pushing her out. It was not even organic.
Like he's got his hands on her trying to get her out of the room. And like, it's so obvious.
Yeah. What do you think Scully thought? Like, does she really think?
I don't know. I mean, she's kind of smiling and laughing a bit at it.
Yeah.
So she obviously isn't like distressed by it. I don't know if she's being serious or not when she says, if you've got a girl coming over, maybe she's like, as my mom would say, half in jest, full in earnest.
Yes.
That like she's making a joke about it, but maybe in the back of her mind, she is thinking, maybe he does have a girl coming over. I mean, he's obviously trying to hide something, but it seems like this is like what we were talking about earlier, where when it comes to Mulder keeping things from Scully, she seems just to kind of roll her eyes and go with it.
It's just a matter of course.
Makes a big deal. Like she just accepts that whatever this is, it doesn't involve me.
Yes.
And I don't need to know, you know, whether he's just going to, you know, he needs to spend some very special alone time. Yeah, it's not really, whatever this is, it's not my business. And I'm okay with that.
Yeah. I always took it as their sort of in joke that he doesn't, Like, because of the way he's like, what's a girl? And like, she kind of laughs. And, like, I feel like they've had a conversation at some point about how he just never gets out. Like, he doesn't have a social life. He doesn't go anywhere. Because, I mean, they actually did in Jersey Devil. She's like, go out, get a beer. Yeah. I will buy. Like, she's just like, please go do something. And I and they also kind of joke about the porn. Like, they like that's already a thing that's happening. And so part of me thinks she's just like, he just suddenly popped one and needs to take care of it. And that's why he needs me to get out of the room. That's honestly what I think is going on. And that's why.
That's the most likely explanation. I mean, he does actually say there's a movie on TV that I want to watch. And she's like, oh, which kind of movie would that be? Exactly?
She's like, yeah, okay. Like, which is so freaking funny to me. I love it. I love it.
Yeah, and then obviously he just leaves and goes to see Deep Throat, and Scully takes no notice of the fact that he has left the motel. I don't know how she would have missed that point.
Well, maybe he waits.
He's not watching.
He probably waits 10 minutes, turns his TV on real loud to the porn channel, and she's like, well, I'm not going to go over there for a while. Like,
I'm going to put the pillow over my ears.
This sounds like a fanfic that needs to be written. That's pretty funny.
I feel like we just wrote it.
We kind of did. You're right. that's amazing. The other thing I wanted to mention, which is the part where he comes out and he's like, Scully, I just need to get the door for you. And her face is priceless.
From the poison drain.
Yes.
She's like, yeah, okay, whatever, weirdo.
Yeah, it's so great. Because the funny thing is that like he sort of has an established precedent for being somewhat gentlemanly with her, right? Like he always kind of politely he'll guide her by the back and he'll hold the door for her and like he'll do things like that. Like I feel like we've seen it. So
it's not totally crazy, but it's just for him to be so insistent about it.
Yeah,
I guess
that's what it is. I think it's the idea that, hey, I'm 50 feet away, but wait, I need to open the door for you. Like, I think that's probably where the face is coming from. It's just so so
she
funny.
She doesn't say something like, what's wrong with you, Mulder? Or what are you talking about? She goes with it to a certain extent.
Well, she may as well with that face, though. Like, that face is, the fuck face.
If I was her, though, I would have more than just my face on. I'd be kind of like, what is wrong with you?
Yeah.
I think she's just used to that.
I think she is, but I think also part of her kind of like likes it and doesn't want to she doesn't want to rock the boat. She's kind of like, that's nice. You're actually like putting me first. You're being so considerate. Like, I actually really think that's in her mind in that moment, what she's thinking. And then
I don't know what's going on, but I'm going to pretend that this is real because that's the outcome I prefer here.
Yeah. It's just cute. And this is such a random, tiny little moment, but these are like the things that we cling to because this is a split second moment, but it says so many things about their relationship.
All at once. And of course, you know, it's all in the acting and the delivery and the body language and all of that. I mean, God, every time I watch season one episodes, I'm like, you two are so loud. Like their body language is incredible. It almost seems like there's more of it in season one than there is in two or three. I really feel like they were like pouring it on from the very beginning. There was just like, no one was putting any stop to anything at that point. It was like, go for it. And it's great. There's just so much happening in season one between those two. The chemistry is strong and it's great. And I mean, in season one, those little tiny moments were all we had. And I mean, there were still us shippers way back then when that's all we had to go on, but it was more than enough. And to this day, still love those moments. They're my favorites.
I agree. I mean, and they're like little treasures. Like you're watching the episode and you're like, wow, when I first saw this, I didn't even really pick up on that as in any way, shape or form, like a shippy thing. But if it has to do with their personal dynamic, it's enough. Like that's all we need is like a teeny little hint of their personal dynamic and we will be happy. Like not just their bickering back and forth about the X-Files, but their actual personal dynamic. And I think that is little moments like that is what make the ship float, so to speak.
That's exactly right. Full steam ahead.
I love it. Well, do you have anything else to say about Eve or Fallen Angel?
No, I really like both of these episodes. They're both really strong episodes, like a lot of season one. And love the fact that they're standalone episodes. They're really strong by themselves. And they're great. Everyone should really, if you don't watch a lot of season one, you should, because it's a great season. There's a lot of great episodes, and these are two terrific and quite different examples.
Yeah, definitely, definitely. And I'm glad we got to go through and make sure that we catch all of these little, you know, part Monster of the Week, part mythology episodes, because I do think there's a lot of great little details that may not be super important, but it just, I think to me, it just shows more of that thing that I am always talking about, that like there is a cohesiveness to what they're trying to do here. And it's important because every time we see it, we should point it out. So
yeah, it's great. And yeah, it's in places where you may not expect it, because there was more going on in Eve than I realized, really, until I started looking for it.
Yeah. Well, we will be back in, I don't know, a couple months, whenever our next mythology, our next stop on our mythology train, if you will, is probably going to be EBE and Erlenmeyer Flask.
Which, I can't wait for EBE. It's my favorite.
Well, I know you love that one. And I love Erlenmeyer Flask. So
I love both of those episodes. I mean, I'm loving the season one stuff. It's so awesome. So yeah, really looking forward to that. So we'll get to that soon enough. And we'll do lots of other awesome stuff along the way, too.
Well, thanks you guys for listening. And again, if you want to talk to us about the mythology or anything that we missed that you want us to cover, please tweet at us at XFD Podcast. And let us know what you guys want to hear about, what you want to talk about, anything else. And we will see you guys next time on X-Files Diaries.
Bye!
Mm-hmm.